Hey, good morning, everybody. This is BIOS 241, and it's Thursday, 27th of March. We're going to finish up autonomic nervous system today fast and then move on to sensory chapter. But let's take a look at the schedule. Am I correct if I remember that last time was your second exam? Yeah, okay. I'm going to turn some lights down. So we didn't have a lecture on Monday. That's on Tuesday. All right, so we're going to carry on. The schedule, the next exam here is, looks like the week right after spring break. But it's not on that Tuesday, it's on a Thursday. So that is April 24th. The chapters that are going to be covered are 9 and 10, which is autonomic nervous system and sensory, 11, 12, and 13. 11 is endocrinology, 12 is muscle, 13 is the first chapter in blood, heart, and circulation. Okay. I will probably be absent on the 10th because I have to be over at the district. So I'm going to put some video lectures that cover this material online, and you'll be able to view those video lectures. And I had some lectures for the respiration chapter. Maybe you looked at those before the test. All right, and so they're in Blackboard right now, and if you didn't look at those, that's too bad, because I think they would have helped you out, but go ahead and do that soon, because I want you to solve any technical difficulties that you may have viewing those videos, because that's the only way that I'll be able to show you some of this information, is via a pre-recorded lecture, okay? Does anybody have difficulty viewing those videos that are in Blackboard right now? Is anybody having difficulty? No, that's a good sign. Yeah, there's a question or okay, what kind of computer do you have? A PC or Mac?
PC.
You have a PC. Okay. Probably the best thing for you to do, and as a matter of fact, it doesn't matter if you have a PC or a Macintosh, but update or get a plug-in, a special media player called VLC, and I have a link in Blackboard for that. It's a free plug-in, and for PC users, it's much more powerful than Windows Media Player, and I've never had a problem seeing the video and audio at the same time. Sometimes with Windows Media Player, I can hear the audio track but not see the video. Other times, I can see the video but not hear the audio. You can try to update your Windows Media Player and it might work just fine. Otherwise, VLC, maybe I'll just jot that down on the board. VLC and another one. VLC and the other is DVX. VLC is a little bit more modern. DVX is a fairly modern program, but I think VLC is even a little bit better. And so where do you download these things? Probably CNET is a good URL because they have a tendency not to load a lot of spyware and spam and other kinds of junk on your computer. You can get these programs at a number of different sites, but I don't know what those other sites will do to your computer that might put some spam in there someplace. I'm not sure. Okay. So CNET is usually a good, safe download site to go to get plugins. Okay, and some of these programs have difficulty playing on a Macintosh, in which case I know that the VLC player works really well with Macintosh. And I think you can even play Flash files on a Macintosh with VLC, but not a mobile phone, and maybe not a tablet, but a notebook or a desktop Mac it works with. Okay? All right, so that's the deal for the schedule, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13. Okay, does anybody have any questions on the autonomic nervous system? Any questions? And I can't remember if I showed, did I show you these slides before? Yeah, autonomic nervous system actions. Okay, just a little synopsis of antagonistic action. Sometimes it's complementary, sometimes it's cooperative with some examples. Of course, most of the time, 90% of the time, the actions or the relationship between parasympathetic and sympathetic is going to be antagonistic, right, if there's dual innervation. Some organs only receive single innervation, like adrenal medulla, the ventricles of the myocardium. So these are some interesting cases that you should probably have on the tip of your tongue. So here is a really good exam figure. I think maybe I'll start right here just to reiterate some information. All right. I hear some applause coming from the back. Okay. So maybe just step out in the hallway, okay, so that you don't interrupt somebody that's trying to listen. Where is that coming from? I'm not sure. Way in the back? Wait, that last row back there? Oh, I see where the problem is. Okay. So let everybody listen. All right, so if you look at this scheme on the slide, does this remind you of an autonomic outflow pathway or a somatic motor pathway? So I'm talking about efferent pathways. And how would you analyze this slide to tell? So go ahead and tell me while I work out my arrow options right here. How do you know that this is an autonomic outflow pathway and not a somatic motor pathway? Because for somatic motor, no ideas. What's the effector organ for a somatic motor pathway? Skeletal muscle, and only skeletal muscle. What are the effector organs for an autonomic outflow pathway? Smooth muscle, I like that. I heard glands, I like that. And cardiac muscle. Yeah, those are all the four different kinds of effectors you have in your body. Some are controlled by the autonomic nervous system, others are controlled by the somatic nervous system. All right, so which one is this here? Is this autonomic or somatic? Autonomic, because you see that it takes two neurons to get from the central nervous system to the effector organ. For a somatic motor outflow pathway, it only requires one neuron, right? Just one motor neuron. Okay. And so there is a ganglion located between the central nervous system and effector organ. And remember, a ganglion is defined. How is a ganglion defined? I'm kind of circling it right here. A ganglion is a collection of nerve cell bodies and dendrites someplace in the peripheral nervous system. And there are parasympathetic and sympathetic ganglia located in various locations. You should be aware of that. But on this slide, it tells us something about the neurotransmitters and receptors for each of these divisions, and it's nicely broken down into parasympathetic and sympathetic, two major columns right here. The first row represents the preganglionic neurons. The second row represents the postganglionic neurons, because it always requires two. But, oh, there's an exception. Where is there a really good exception to that rule? Probably you should know that. You should have that on the tip of your tongue. Where is there an autonomic outflow pathway that only has a single neuron? And it's the one that goes to the adrenal medulla, right? There's a splanchnic nerve that goes through the sympathetic chain, so it's a sympathetic outflow pathway. It goes right through the sympathetic chain into a splanchnic nerve to the medulla, and then the cells of the medulla act like the postganglionic cell in the sympathetic outflow pathway, but those cells of the adrenal medulla don't send action potentials anywhere. When they depolarize, they just release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the blood. So they kind of act like a postganglionic cell, but they kind of also act like an endocrine cell because of the way they transmit or release norepinephrine and epinephrine, right? It's more like a hormone. Okay, so let's look at the junction between the pre- and postganglionic neurons, and that is in a ganglion. And we see that in every case, 100% of the time, what is going to be the neurotransmitter? Doesn't matter if it's parasympathetic or sympathetic. It's going to be acetylcholine, right? So all of these preganglionic fibers, and I mean nerve fibers, are they cholinergic or adrenergic? They're cholinergic. All of these are cholinergic neurons, which means that the receptors on the postganglionic cells have to be cholinergic receptors. And you know of two major classes of cholinergic receptors, two major different kinds. What are the two major different kinds? We have some that respond to nicotine. We have some that respond to muscarin. Hence, their name, nicotinic, if they respond to nicotine, or muscarinic, if they respond to muscarin. And muscarin won't stimulate a nicotinic receptor, although acetylcholine will bind and stimulate both. Right, and that's because there's some similarity in shape between all these different molecules. All right, so The question was, what kind of receptors are on all of these postganglionic fibers within the ganglion? Is it a nicotinic or muscarinic type? And it's going to be a nicotinic type. It's just going to be just a plain old ion channel that opens up. That receptor binds two acetylcholines, then a sodium channel opens up. And what will sodium do then? Is it going to move in the cell, move out of the cell, or is it happy just the way it is? Okay. Where is sodium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. That's right. And when that channel opens, sodium is going to rush inside the cell. Then what else can you tell me about that? That's depolarization. And what does that really mean when a cell depolarizes? Is that excitatory or inhibitory? That's excitatory, right? So these are all nicotinic receptors right here causing depolarization in the postganglionic cell anytime acetylcholine is released. Oh, it says right here, nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. Maybe that's why you all were looking at me kind of funny, because it just says right here, right on the slide. All right, so if we look at this scheme right here, here are some examples of cholinergic receptors. We see nice membranes, right? I see a nice phospholipid bilayer, phospholipid bilayer, phospholipid bilayer. And we said that on the postganglionic fiber, it has a nicotinic type acetylcholine receptor. And that acetylcholine receptor has to bind two acetylcholines. It's going to change the conformation of this protein that goes across the membrane, opening up this channel so that sodium can enter the cell. Ah, and that is depolarization, just like you all informed me, which causes excitation of the cell because it brings the membrane potential closer to threshold or up to threshold. Right? So that is really nice. Just a simple ion-gated channel. Muscarinic receptors, on the other hand, work through a different kind of mechanism. These, what is this system right here called? A G-protein coupled receptor. So here's the receptor, here's the G-protein. The channel doesn't open up through the receptor. It's a solid protein within the membrane wall. But when acetylcholine binds to the receptor, then it releases the G-protein. G-protein can dissociate, remember, into an alpha particle or a beta-gamma particle, which can then float around on the surface of the membrane and bump into other kinds of proteins that are in the cell membrane. And that activated or released G-protein maybe bumps into a potassium channel. And maybe it opens up this potassium channel. And when the potassium channel opens up, potassium can leave the cell. And when potassium leaves the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? Okay, what kind of charge does potassium have? It's a cation, so it has a positive charge. When it leaves the cell, it carries that charge with us. So what happens to the electrical charge inside the cell? It becomes more negative. We know that to be hyperpolarization. And that causes inhibition of the cell because it moves the membrane potential farther away from threshold. So muscarinic receptors can be inhibitory. But look at this other case over here. Some muscarinic receptors are excitatory. How can that happen? There could be two different ways. Right? Acetylcholine binds to the receptor, releases the G protein, and these different subunits can bump into other kinds of proteins. If it is a potassium channel that is open, and when the G protein bumps into it, it closes, that prevents potassium from leaving the cell. That's another way of saying depolarization. Okay, so the cell, the membrane potential is going to become more positive. Right? That's depolarization. What do you know about depolarization? That is excitation, right? If this potassium channel closes. But here is another channel that it's possible to bump into, and it is a sodium channel. And in this particular case, what has to happen to the sodium channel if it causes depolarization, or another way of thinking about that, excitation? That channel has to open up, right? So when that activated G protein bumps into this sodium channel, it has to open up. So it causes a conformation change from being closed to open. Sodium enters the cell. That causes depolarization or excitation because that makes the membrane potential move toward threshold or even meet threshold. And the calcium ion will do the same thing. It could be a calcium channel. So it could be calcium or sodium. So why does sodium or calcium do the same thing in this particular case? because they are both, they're both cations, right? They both have positive charge. Okay. All right, so these are the two types of muscarinic receptors. And the muscarinic receptors we have on the parasympathetic nervous system, on the postganglionic fiber. Right, so that fiber is going to release acetylcholine. The effector organ has muscarinic type receptors, which can be excitatory or inhibitory depending on what the organ is. Okay. So does anybody know from anatomy what the parasympathetic effects on the heart are? I had mentioned that on a table previous, but probably haven't memorized the table, but you got to be a little familiar with that. There's dual innervation to the atria of the heart, in particular the SA node, so it's going to affect the heart rate. What is parasympathetic stimulation on the heart rate? Speed it up, slow it down, or no effect? It slows it down. So that means that acetylcholine must bind to a muscarinic receptor that inhibits the SA node on the heart. Because the sympathetic, right, or norepinephrine at the SA node is going to be excitatory. So parasympathetic is inhibitory, sympathetic is excitatory, and really perfect example of antagonism, controlling your heart rate. And that just means you have what? Precise control and balance over heart rate. And that's a really important organ that you have that kind of control over. Nice antagonistic control. The other thing this diagram shows is that what kind of adrenergic receptors. It shows you that the cholinergic are muscarinic, but what about the adrenergic receptors on the heart? What are those? Remember, it could be alpha or beta, but it could be subclasses of alpha or beta. How many hearts do you have? You got one. So that might help you remember. It's a beta 1 type receptor, which is excitatory. And now what about your lungs? I think we have an example here of lungs. What kind of receptors, what kind of adrenergic receptors do lungs have? Yeah, beta 2. Remember, so because you have a right and left lung, just think of beta 2. And the beta 2, is it excitatory or inhibitory on the smooth muscle of bronchioles, for instance? And we might relate this to the fight or flight mechanism as well. Beta 2s are inhibitory, that smooth muscle relaxes, bronchioles dilate, and then is it easier or harder to breathe when bronchioles dilate? When we get through the cardiovascular chapter, it will make a whole lot more sense. But when there's dilation of a tube, then flow through that tube increases. So when the smooth muscle of a bronchiole is inhibited so that the bronchial can dilate, then much more air can flow through that tube much more quickly. Right, the flow increases dramatically. All right, for beta 2. Alpha 1s are always excitatory, causing vasoconstriction, for instance, in viscera and skin, so that blood goes to muscles in particular. Okay, so anybody have a question on this slide here? Probably not. When you look it over, it will make pretty good sense. All right, so don't forget, there are two different kinds of cholinergic receptors, either nicotinic and muscarinic. And I have to tell you that there are even subclasses of these, but we're not going to cover them in this class, okay? But you might have to look at them at some point in time. All right, and so here we see some subclasses of muscarinic receptors, but here, this table, 9.6, just is a nice tabulation of some responses and the mechanisms by which different receptors can produce excitation or inhibition by opening different kinds of channels. So I think it's just kind of fun to look over these things. And that's it for this chapter. Okay. Indeed, that's it. So now we get to go to a fun chapter, which is sensory physiology. And I think you should be able to relate to this one pretty easily because we all enjoy our senses. Right, and we're kind of familiar with that. And what the heck, what was the senses chapter? What number was that? 10? Indeed, you are right. Okay, so here's chapter 10. All right, so am I ignoring anybody? Anybody have a question? No, looking good. Okay, so in order for you to become aware of some kind of energy modality in your environment, what do you have to have? So in order for you to be able to sense light, what do you need? Yeah, you need a receptor, in particular a photoreceptor, right? In order for you to appreciate temperature, you need a thermal receptor. And in order for you to monitor glucose concentration in the blood, you need a glucose receptor, right, in some organs, for instance, like the pancreas. All right, so let's talk about these receptors. What do? They change energy from one form to another, right? So they change, for instance, light energy into electrical energy that is moving through our neurons, right? So a receptor will transduce environmental information into action potentials. And what can you tell me about an action potential? What do you know about an action potential? A whole bunch of stuff, but let's see if you can follow what I'm trying to get at. I'm speaking to you in English right now. That's a hint. How do different parts of the brain, or actually different parts of the nervous system, how do they talk to each other? Probably not English. I mean, your mind can understand English, but what is the language that your nervous system uses? It is action potentials, right? And remember, what's the difference between one action potential and another? What's the difference? What about action potentials that develop because of a light stimulus as compared to a chemical stimulus, as compared to a thermal stimulus or a vibration stimulus? What's the difference between all those action potentials? Nothing. They're all exactly the same. But remember, intensity is coded by the frequency of action potentials, even though they're all exactly the same, right? Intensity. But now what about the modality itself? How is it that we can tell the difference between something we hear and something we see? Because action potentials go to different parts of the cerebral cortex. If action potentials go to the occipital lobe, what kind of experience will you have? Occipital lobe? Yeah, you'll have a visual experience. If action potentials go to the temporal lobe, what kind of experience will you have? An auditory experience, right? So it's exactly the same kind of action potentials, but the rate at which they're arriving codes for intensity, and where it goes tells you what your experience is in terms of that modality. All right, so as a matter of fact, each kind of receptor, right, responds best to just one kind of modality, one form. Like your ears, your hearing receptors will respond to sound the best, and if we shine a flashlight in your ear, you won't be able to hear anything or see anything, right? But if we put sound waves in there, you'll be able to hear it. And if we hook up a loudspeaker to your eyes and it vibrates back and forth, right, you won't see sound, right, because it's not the right modality. But if we turn that loudspeaker up very, very, very loud so that your eyeballs are really bouncing around inside your head, guess what? You'll probably see something. Okay, it just means that a particular kind of receptor, if it's a photoreceptor, will do the best job transducing light energy into action potentials, right? Not that it can't do any other kind of thing, but it does the best job doing that. All right, so what kind of receptors? By shape, some of them can be very complicated, like these lamellated type receptors, Pacinian corpuscles that are deep within your integumentary system, Meissner's corpuscles up very close to the epidermis, and Ruffini's end organs very close to the epidermis. So Meissner's and Ruffini's are good for very slight pressure, slight vibration. Right? Pacinian corpuscles are more for deep pressure. So you have receptors for both of those. And these are just modified dendritic organs. All right. Other ways that we can classify receptors, chemoreceptors can sense the presence of different kinds of chemicals and maybe the concentrations of different kinds of chemicals. Photoreceptors will transduce light, thermoreceptors for temperature changes. What about mechanoreceptors? What could a mechanoreceptor be good for? All right, here's kind of a strange example. It could be good for monitoring blood pressure inside your blood vessels. Because what might happen to a blood vessel when the pressure inside that vessel increases? Think of a balloon. If we were to increase air pressure inside of a balloon, what is a balloon going to do? Is it going to change shape? Indeed it will. It will get bigger. It will start to stretch. So a good example of a mechanoreceptor for blood pressure is a stretch receptor. When blood vessels stretch, then these mechanoreceptors will change the frequency of action potentials going to the cardioregulatory center in the medulla. Nociceptors respond to damaging stimulus to our bodies, and that could be temperature, could be chemical, could be freezing cold, could be searing hot, could be various kinds of chemicals like acids, for instance. So we have nociceptors for that. Or anybody ever breathe in ammonia? Anybody almost pass out and somebody break open a little vial of ammonia and put it underneath your nose? Okay, it stimulated those nociceptors in your nasal passageway, and it's a very powerful response, right? So that might actually deviate you, bring you out of a syncope episode. All right, proprioceptors. These are important. They belong to all of these other kinds of receptors. They don't belong to the same class as visual receptors and hearing receptors. Proprioceptors will monitor and measure tension in all of the skeletal muscles in your body. All right, and will monitor the stretch or the position of skeletal muscles in your body and how much tension is being applied to a particular tendon. And all that information is then sent to the central nervous system, the cerebellum, so that you have proper control of your body, right? So these things then set up a feedback loop so that when you tell a biceps muscle to contract, it contracts properly so that you don't punch yourself in the nose, right? So even with your eyes closed, I could take your hand and put it above your head, and what would you tell me? You're not sitting on it, right? You would know your hand is above your head because of these proprioceptors. And if I were to put a heavy weight on top of your hand, you could tell me it was a heavy weight because of proprioception. And you have these all over your body. So that takes us to two general classes of receptors. General receptors, you have all over your body. Like if I take an ice cube and put it on your kneecap, could you feel it? Yeah, if I put it on your earlobe, could you feel it? On your back, belly button, you could feel it. So you have thermoreceptors all over your body, so we call that a general sensation. You have receptors all over. As opposed to a special sense, you have the ability to receive that information in one or two places on your body, and that's it. A good example would be vision. If I take a flashlight, shine it on your belly button, will you see it? No. All right, on your fingernail, will you see it? No, only if it goes into your eyes, right? So there's only one, maybe two locations. We call that a special sense. The special senses are sight, hearing, and what about taste? Can you use your fingertips for taste? No, you need your tongue. So that is a special sense as well. All right, so, and what about smell? Can you use your fingertips for smelling? No, only your nose. So that's another special sense. So the special senses, probably I should just enumerate them for you right now, will be vision, hearing, smell. What is smell? The official name is olfaction, the olfaction sense. All right, so that's three. And what's the name for taste? It's the gustatory sensation. That happens only on your tongue, so that's four. Ooh, did I say hearing? I didn't say hearing yet. I did say hearing? Okay, so that's four. But there's something else involved with your ear, part of the vestibular apparatus, right? It's for equilibrium, and you have two different senses for equilibrium, right? Both in either side of the ear. One is what we call, and it says right here, equilibrium. There are two different kinds of equilibrium. There's static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. Kinetic is for monitoring spinning motions. Sometimes we call that angular acceleration. And static equilibrium is for linear acceleration, and that's spinning. Okay, those are all in your inner ear. Yeah, okay. Maybe I should write it down so I don't repeat them twice. I like vision. Oh, the static and kinetic. Yeah, static and kinetic. Static is linear acceleration. And kinetic is for angular acceleration. Another way of thinking of angular acceleration is spinning. You have a special apparatus in your ear for doing that. We went over that in anatomy. Okay, but we'll go over it again. Okay. Sometimes they're also called kinetic, sometimes might be called dynamic equilibrium, static equilibrium. I'll go over it. So I like linear acceleration versus angular acceleration, but that might not mean anything to you unless you know what acceleration is. All right, so what do you have on your car to make sure that you don't get a speeding ticket? Okay, you have an odometer. That measures the distance that you go. Is that what you said, odometer? What else do you have? Ah, speedometer, yeah. So speed is just a distance per time, like a mile per hour. A mile is a distance. All right, so that's velocity. That's not acceleration. What acceleration is when you're changing your velocity, when you're going from 0 to 100 miles an hour. That's acceleration. All right, or when you go from 100 miles an hour to 5 miles an hour, that's deceleration. That's another kind of acceleration. So those are the things that can be monitored in your ear. Your ear can't tell you what velocity you're going, right, if you're speeding or not, but it can definitely tell you if that velocity is changing. And that would be linear acceleration. The angular part would have to do with spinning, okay, as opposed to just a change in velocity. All right, so there are some other characteristics of receptors you should be aware of. There can be tonic receptors or phasic receptors. Tonic receptors are shown on the top line. So if a stimulus is applied, a proper kind of stimulus, for instance, maybe pain to a pain receptor, and it's applied, and it will produce an action potential. And if it stays applied, what happens to these action potentials? Do they change in height? Do they change in duration? They don't. Do they change in frequency? Okay. I see 1, 2 in a short period of time, and then I see 1, 2, same period of time. If I look way over here, same period of time, I see 2 action potentials. So guess what? The frequency is staying the same, whether it's right when you apply the stimulus or if that stimulus is being applied maybe even a day later. The shape of these action potentials and the frequency of action potentials are exactly the same. All right, so this is what we call a tonic receptor. Not all receptors do that. For instance, here is one maybe for smell. Maybe you have noticed that when you walk in the library, a lot of libraries have the same kind of smell. They all smell like books, right? Kind of like a musty smell. And it's actually pretty obvious. And after you've been in there, maybe a half hour or so, do you smell all those books? No, it kind of escapes your consciousness, right? And that's because olfactory receptors are phasic receptors. They habituate. So if you have a olfactory stimulus applied, keep that stimulus at the same intensity, look what happens to action potentials. What about their height? Stays the same. What about their duration? Stays the same. But in a certain period of time, what happens to these action potentials? Very early on, there are many, many, many action potentials for one unit of time. And then later, I see a unit of time over here where there's not even any action potentials, right? So we see that the frequency of action potentials is decreasing over time, and we call that a phasic receptor. And this is due to the type of receptor, not to fatigue in a neuron, right? So I think that's important to know. And we call that adaptation. A good example would be touch and smell. Touch receptors adapt because probably when you put your shoes on first thing in the morning, you can tell you have your shoes on even with your eyes closed, right? Because you have that touch sensation coming from your feet. But what about right now? Are you feeling your shoes on your feet? Probably not. Not unless you really think about it or move your feet around, right? Because those touch receptors have adapted and you're not paying attention to them. Okay, so know the difference between tonic and phasic receptors. I'm sure you guys go over that in lab. Here is a nice important concept. There's a couple of questions at the end of a chapter. It's called the law of specific nerve energies. And this just says that an adequate stimulus is the normal stimulus for that receptor. And it's the kind of stimulus that most easily causes excitation of that receptor. So what would be the adequate stimulus for a photoreceptor in your eye? Would be light. That's right. And if we mechanically deform your eyeball, like vibrate it or something, that might stimulate those photoreceptors, but that's not an adequate stimulus because that energy would have to be much, much greater than just light energy. Remember, you can see a candle from miles away. Okay. Like when you rub your eyes or you hit your head, yeah, you'll see things. So you'll get some kind of visual experience. Of course, it won't correspond to what normally you're looking at, and that's because you are stimulating those receptors mechanically. But that mechanical stimulation is not an adequate stimulus, right? It's just not an adequate stimulus. Light would be the adequate stimulus. So adequate stimulus is the type of stimulus, not the amount. I think you should maybe just write that down to help answer some of those questions at the end of this chapter. Adequate stimulus is the type, not the amount. If it is the wrong type, then you need a very intense stimulus. If it is the right type, right, if it is the adequate stimulus, then you just need low levels of stimulus to produce a response. So on table 10.1, we see some different kinds of receptors, what the normal stimulus is, right? Photoreceptors would be light, but that doesn't mean that if there's a large chemical imbalance in the eye or if there's mechanical disruption of the eye, you won't perceive light, right? But light is the adequate stimulus for photoreceptors. What's an adequate stimulus for a chemoreceptor? Dissolved chemicals in your body, for instance, like maybe hydrogen ions or glucose or salt, for instance. Okay, so these are the adequate stimuli. So how does a receptor work? Well, it produces these things over here. So we have a membrane potential, so we have voltage on the vertical axis. It's not really shown on this particular slide, versus time, right? So it's voltage versus time, so we're measuring membrane potential. What is line number one right here? What's line number one? You know what that is? That is? That's RMP. That's right. Okay. And when the receptor is stimulated by its adequate stimulus, then those membranes are going to depolarize depending on the intensity or the amount of that stimulus. So I see that there is a stimulus number one and a stimulus number two and a stimulus number three. And what can you tell me about these stimuli right here, all three of these? What are they causing? Depolarization, which is excitation, because why? It brings the membrane potential closer to threshold. Threshold is signified by this dotted line. And so most sensory receptors produce, what are these things, EPSPs or IPSPs? Yeah, these are excitations or EPSPs. So you should think of these things as graded potentials. They're not action potentials. Sometimes they're called synaptic potentials in a synapse. But if it is a receptor, we call these things generator potentials, not synaptic potentials. But generator potentials are graded potentials. They can summate, they die away as they travel across the neuron, and they're used to produce action potentials if they add together to reach a threshold stimulus. If a threshold stimulus is released, right, then that produces an action potential, and you should know all the parts of this action potential and what ions are involved, right? Here's depolarization produced by, most commonly, an influx of sodium. Here is repolarization. Most commonly, you know that to be an efflux of potassium, meaning potassium leaving the cell, and then we even have a little area of relative inhibition right here due to this hyperpolarization. Okay, so this is a response to an adequate stimulus. So generator potentials are proportional to the stimulus intensity, right? And they can have different intensity the height of these generator potentials is determined by the stimulus intensity. And then if they reach threshold, action potential is started at the axon hillock, right? And then it travels down the axon. In phasic receptors, generator potentials adapt to a constant stimulus, right? So the neuron doesn't fatigue, neurotransmitters at a synapse don't run out. It's the generator potentials that decrease if the stimulus is held constant, if it is a phasic kind of receptor. Probably run into some concepts with that in lab. Tonic receptors, generator potentials, they do not adapt to a constant stimulus. So let's look at the stimulus. I have three different stimuli right here, right, and they're held on for the same period of time, but the three stimuli have different intensities. First a very low intensity, then a little bit higher, and then a little bit higher once again. So that's the stimulus intensity. And this is going to be a tonic receptor. And what does a tonic receptor do? Does it adapt or not adapt? Tonic does not adapt, right? So if it's stimulated, then it's going to produce the same frequency of action potentials. All right, so we turn this stimulus on, and the stimulus is going to produce a generator potential for stimulus number one, and it's an EPSP. But what can you tell me about this generator potential? It is excitatory. It does move the membrane potential closer to threshold, but does it meet threshold? It does not. So it's a sub-threshold stimulus, and so then, since it doesn't reach threshold, no action potentials are stimulated, and there's no perception of this particular stimulus because the generator potentials are too small. If we increase the stimulus intensity, right, then the intensity of the generator potential increases as well. They are directly related to each other. Generator potentials vary in intensity along with the stimulus, unlike action potentials, right? Action potentials are always the same intensity. So this stimulus right here does depolarize the membrane up to threshold, and when it does, when it reaches threshold, what happens? That triggers an action potential. We see it right here. All right, and then there's a refractory period and a relative refractory period. And then sooner or later, the stimulus, even though it's at the same intensity, is able to overcome that relative refractory period, which then triggers another action potential, which then puts that neuron into a refractory period. And this slight stimulus then can still reach threshold, overcome that refractory period, and we have another action potential. And if we don't change the intensity of the stimulus, the frequency of action potentials does not change. And of course, the intensity doesn't change, the duration of an action potential does not change either. All right, so what does your brain sound like when it is talking in these action potentials? You won't be able to go home until you tell me. What's happening in your brain? What's happening in your brain? What's the language? I want to hear that language. It's action potential. Yeah, that's in English, but I want to, what does the brain hear? What does the brain listen to? What do we got? Blip, 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 blip. All right, and these blips go to a certain part of your brain that tells you what the modality is. And if you hear just those few blips in that long period of time, what can you tell me about the intensity of that stimulus? It is relatively low, right? Okay. Well, let's turn the intensity up of the stimulus. Keep it on for the same period of time. So now, because the stimulus intensity increased, the generator potential amplitude increased way past threshold. So because it's way past threshold, it can overcome that relative refractory period sooner, right, compared to a lower amplitude generator potential. So action potentials will be generated much more quickly compared to the lower intensity stimulus. And so the height of this action potential is exactly the same as this first train over here. The duration is exactly the same. But what is different compared to case number two? What's different about number three compared to number two? The frequency of action potentials. All right, so what is, how is your brain talking to itself right now? Very fast, right? So that's how your brain communicates with these little blips, but now you know a lot about these blips. What are these blips? These blips are action potentials. And where do these action potentials exist? Only axons, right? Okay. In nervous tissue. We're going to talk about muscles later on. All right, so special senses. Here's a special part of the chapter. All right, and what are those special senses once again? Vision, hearing, smell, taste, equilibrium, two different kinds of equilibrium. All right, so there have to be special receptors involved with these senses. And they're located only in a couple locations in your body. All right, taste and smell. We can call these exteroreceptors because they respond to chemicals that are in the environment outside your body. So extro means outside your body. Intro means that there are receptors for chemicals inside your body. Taste and smell are exteroreceptors because they respond to chemicals in our environment. So you're communicating with your environment when those receptors become stimulated. The first one we're going to talk about is gustation. And where is it that you can taste things once again? On your tongue, right? And you probably know that there are taste buds on your tongue, and if you go in and look in a mirror and stick your tongue out and go, ah, you see a bunch of papillae on your tongue. Now, are those the same things as taste buds? You know, and probably in anatomy, maybe you learned that they are not, because you could see those papillae with your naked eye. But shown on this slide is a taste bud. And here is a cell. And here's another cell, here's a third, here's a fourth, here's a fifth, and there's a couple more over here. Can you see these cells with your naked eye? You cannot. You cannot see a taste bud with your naked eye. These things populate the papillae that you can see on your tongue. All right. So we said that these things respond to chemicals in your environment, so that means for taste, those chemicals have to enter your mouth. Otherwise, you can't taste them. All right. So if there's a sugar cube on that handrail over there, I can't taste it. Until that sugar enters my mouth, it dissolves in saliva, becomes part of the solution, and then that solution can enter the taste pore, and a glucose molecule, something sweet, can bind to a taste hair, which is some specialized cilia that's on this apical surface of this taste cell. So that molecule actually has to bind, and when it binds, it changes the electrical properties of this taste cell. And when it changes the electrical properties, it creates what, a generator potential, which then sets up an action potential in this sensory nerve. What kind of nerves are sensory by shape? Do you remember? What kind of shape are those? What are they? It could be multipolar, it could be unipolar, it could be pseudo-unipolar. Okay, pseudo-unipolar is a typical kind of sensory neuron. Okay, except when we get to special senses, we are going to see some bipolar neurons. And that's really about the only place where we see some bipolar neurons. All right, so we have a sense of sweet, we have a sense of sour, salty, bitter, and umami. So these are five, 5 different senses. And pretty much everybody agrees that these are the 5 different primary sensations that we have for taste. And that anything we taste is just some other combination or some combination of these 5 senses, and we can appreciate what it is. All right, so we don't have thousands and thousands and thousands of different kind receptors for all those different tastes that we can taste. And you might be able to relate to this, because what kind of, for instance, what kind of drink might stimulate sweet, sour, and salty? Or sweet, bitter? Nah, sweet, sour, and salty. How about a margarita? Exact, perfect example. Okay? So that's how these complicated senses get broken down into their components. And right, with practice, I'm not recommending a lot of practice in this particular case. Right? With practice, you can break down, right, things that you eat into these sensations and identify what they are. So these taste receptor cells are just modified epithelial cells. They kind of look like epithelium. And we have as many as 100 of these taste buds, or 100 of these cells in each taste bud. And each bud can respond to just to all kinds of different categories, these 5 different categories, because they have different receptors in these cilia. Okay. All right, there was a time when we used to think that certain parts of the tongue were more responsible for one or other of these senses. Okay, like sweet would be on the tip of your tongue or the sides of your tongue. And now there's a lot of controversy. We don't really think that so much. You probably have these taste receptors all over your tongue. It's just that I think culture and the way we grow up and the kind of foods that we eat, maybe you learn how to appreciate these different senses on different parts of your tongue. So culture probably has plays a large role in that. All right, so how do these receptors work? All right, so let's look at some of the molecular aspects of these receptors. So here's a taste hair cell. We can see some of these cilia poking off that apical surface. And let's analyze that first sense. What was the first sense? It was? Oh, it was sweet. But I want to talk about salty first. Sorry. So I want to talk about salt. And what is salt made out of? Sodium and chloride. Are you familiar with sodium? Have you learned anything about sodium in this class? Probably a little bit, right? So it's an ion, it's a cation, dissolves in water very easily because it's a polar compound. So when you have salt, right, it dissolves very easily in saliva, enters through that taste pore, and it can bump into the cell. And it just so happens, here is a sodium channel, right, that's poking into the taste pore. And when you have salt in saliva, that salt or the sodium can enter the cell. And what do you know that to be? Depolarization, right? That's an excitatory event on the cell. So this cell depolarizes. When it depolarizes down by the more basal region, that opens up calcium channels. And you know calcium is high outside the cell. Calcium enters the cell, and that causes release of neurotransmitter, excitatory neurotransmitter, okay, which produces generator potentials on the sensory neuron that go then to the gustation center in your cerebral cortex. So that's how salty works. Sodium just enters the cell. That's a nice simple mechanism. Okay, sour is due to the amount of acid that's in a food. And what is pH measure? You could say acid, but what is it that is really measuring? What is something that is acidic? It donates protons to solution, right? So when you eat something with a lot of protons in it, it is highly acidic, right? So we have these hydrogen ions. Hydrogen ion and a proton is exactly the same thing. For these kind of receptor cells, instead of having sodium channels that are always open, there are proton channels that are open. So then when we eat something sour, some acid in our mouth, these protons or hydrogen ions can enter the cell. And then what happens to this taste cell? What happens to it? And why? What's the charge on a hydrogen ion? Does it have a charge? Indeed it does. It has a positive charge. Just like what? Just like sodium. So when a hydrogen ion enters its cell, it causes depolarization, right? Because it's a cation. And that depolarization, again, also opens up calcium channels, which causes release of neurotransmitter, and that sets up EPSPs in this neuron, and then eventually action potentials that go to the gustation center. Right, so again, we can explain the taste of sour very easily just by invoking proton channels, salty by invoking sodium channels. Yeah. This calcium? Well, we just know that calcium is at a high concentration outside the cell. Okay, it just pretty much typically is all over the place. And it's a very important signaling compound pretty much in every cell in your body. And if calcium enters a cell, it's going to change the physiology of that cell, pretty much every cell in your body. Okay, so that's why it's at a high concentration outside. Calcium is in our diet, and it is actively pumped out of cells. Right, so there's ATP always kicking calcium from inside the cell to the outside. So that calcium concentration in cytosol is very low. There are other calcium pumps. Not only are there calcium pumps that kick calcium outside the cell, making extracellular calcium high, there are calcium pumps in endoplasmic reticulum, smooth type of endoplasmic reticulum. There are calcium pumps that take calcium from the cytosol and put it inside the endoplasmic reticulum. And that then also reduces calcium in the cytosol. But that also means calcium builds up inside the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And it can be used. Let's see if it's going to be used in any of these schemes. All right, so that's two of the five. Sweet and umami, right, work through this kind of mechanism. It's not just a ion channel, but okay, it works through a G-protein coupled receptor. Oh, have you ever heard of these things before? Probably a little bit, some intricate details of that G-protein coupled receptor. So sugar molecules bind to the receptor, right? And does that sugar molecule have to enter the cell to have a response? not for G-protein receptor, because the G-protein is the second messenger. The sugar is the first messenger. Sugar stays outside the cell all the time, right? The G-protein is inside the cell all the time. And this second messenger comes over to potassium channels, right, which are normally open, right? So if a potassium channel is normally open, what's happening to the cell without a stimulus? If a potassium channel is open, potassium is leaving the cell, which does what? That inhibits the cell, right? But when the second messenger builds up, it closes these potassium channels, which is causing depolarization when that happens, right? If potassium leaves, that maintains polarization or hyperpolarizes the membrane, but when these potassium channels close, that causes depolarization. We know that to be excitatory, right? Depolarization is excitatory. That causes release of neurotransmitter, produces generator potentials on this neuron, and then that information is sent to the brain. That works through for both the sweet and umami type chemicals, like amino acids and sugar molecules, right, will bind to different kinds of receptors based on their shape. And it's a G-protein coupled receptor. Bitter works the same way, but a little bit different kind of mechanism inside the cell. It's a G-protein coupled receptor, right? A good example of a bitter kind of compound is quinine. You can buy this in the grocery store. How could you buy in a liquor store? Maybe I shouldn't tell you that. But various kinds of stores, you can get quinine. Where can you buy quinine? In tonic water. So maybe go get some tonic water from someplace, drink some, and I see some people making a funny face because it tastes how? Bitter. It has a bitter taste. All right, so when quinine binds to this receptor, this G-protein is activated, that produces a second messenger. This second messenger, okay, goes over to the endoplasmic reticulum and opens calcium pores on the endoplasmic reticulum, and then what happens? Remember, smooth ER is a reservoir for calcium, high concentration, very, very low or zero in the cytosol, so calcium leaves the endoplasmic reticulum, and that calcium then is a signal to release neurotransmitters. So it causes the fusion of these synaptic vesicles, and that releases excitatory neurotransmitter. Okay, produces generator potentials, and which could produce action potentials later on. All right, so those are, what, four different kinds of schemes produced by these five different modalities. Okay, so it's just molecules in our environment. Yeah. Second messenger, okay, where is the first messenger always located? Outside the cell. Where's the second messenger always located? Inside the cell. In particular, right, in these examples, right, the G-protein is activated. So you could think of an activated and dissociated G-protein, either the alpha, the beta, or the gamma. Could be a second messenger. All right. But we also saw a circumstance where some of those activated alpha-beta units can bump into an enzyme on the membrane. And like, for instance, it could bump into an adenylate cyclase enzyme and turn it on, because when those things bump into the protein, changes the conformation of adenylate cyclase, activating it. And can anybody remember what adenylate cyclase does? Adenylate cyclase. Cyclase is like the key, the hint. Adenylate cyclase takes an ATP, chops off two phosphoruses and makes it an AMP, but what kind of AMP? A special kind, a cyclic AMP. So that cyclic AMP then is inside the cell, that becomes a second messenger inside the cell. Yeah. The second messenger diffuses by concentration difference, right? Down to the membrane over here, bumps into these potassium channels, and when it does, it closes these potassium channels. So instead of causing hyperpolarization, now the cell starts to depolarize. And in this particular case, the second messenger doesn't bump into channels necessarily in the membrane, but it goes to the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And this, one of the jobs of smooth endoplasmic reticulum is to store calcium. So if calcium channels are opened up, then calcium just rushes out of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And that calcium then is the signal for neurotransmitter release. right? So these synaptic vesicles hop a ride on a microtubule, right, and they fuse and dock to the presynaptic membrane, and when they do, they exocytose the neurotransmitter into this synaptic cleft, which then produces an EPSP on this neuron down over here. So you could think of a G protein as being a second messenger because it's always inside the cell. You could think of adenylate cyclase as being a second messenger because it's always inside the cell. And as a matter of fact, I wouldn't even say it would be wrong to think of calcium as being a second messenger in this particular scheme, because where do you find this calcium? It's always inside the cell. Okay? It doesn't, in this particular case, it doesn't go from outside to inside. All right, so there's different ways you can look at that second messenger. Okay, so that's for gestation. Any other questions on that? Yeah. Ah, okay. It works through potassium channels. So we have smooth endoplasmic reticulum here. There's calcium in there, but it's not important for this particular pathway. I don't see any calcium channels, right? I just see potassium. If a potassium channel is open, potassium is going to leave the cell, right? And what's the charge on a potassium? It does have a charge. It's positive. When a positive leaves the cell, what happens to the electrical charge inside the cell? Becomes more negative, and we know that to be hyperpolarization, right? That inhibits the cell. So by closing these channels right here, the potassium can't leave. So that means those positive charges are not trapped inside the cell. It can't be hyperpolarized. And basically what happens then, the cell depolarizes. The opposite thing happens, right? Because these positive charges stay inside the cell. They can't leave. So they build. Why do they build up inside the cell? Well, sodium potassium pump, right? We'll just pump them in, kick sodium out. So if we close these potassium channels, the sodium potassium ATP pump is going to import some potassium. Okay, but only 2 potassiums for every 3 sodiums. So, okay, so that's going to cause depolarization of the membrane, as opposed to hyperpolarization if potassium can just leak out. And that depolarization is excitatory. Okay. All right, so these are taste cells. Sometimes we might even want to call these hair cells, because these things kind of look like hairs on top of the taste cells. Olfaction is very similar. All right, so here we have a nice nasal cavity. Here is a sphenoid bone, right? Nice sphenoid sinus. Here's a frontal bone with a frontal sinus, and in between we have part of the cribriform plate with olfactory foramina all over the place in them. So what bone is this right here with all these olfactory foramina? It's probably even on this slide. I hate that one that's on the slide, because I want you to recall. What bone is this with olfactory foramina? This is the ethmoid bone, that's one reason why it's a pretty cool bone in your head. So there are neurons, okay, that leave your brain, in particular these olfactory bulbs go through these olfactory foramina, and they're just dangling down here in your nasal cavity. That's the only place I know of on our body where we have neurons actually exiting and dangling around in free space. All right, and as a result of that, you can imagine what's the lifespan of these neurons. Relatively short, because anything you breathe in, right, has access to these neurons. If it's a toxic substance or not toxic or hot or cold, right, can affect these neurons. And so there are receptor cells. And so we call those olfactory receptor neurons. Right, here is one. It's embedded in an epithelial layer. And, oh, look at the shape of this neuron. What does this look like here? What's the shape of this one? Does that look like multipolar? Does it look like pseudo-unipolar? No, here is a nice bipolar neuron. And here are some of those cilia that are poking down into the nasal cavity through this epithelium. Remember, this epithelium just covers the surface of the ethmoid bone in your nasal cavity. And there are receptors for different shaped molecules, which we call odorant molecules, that bind to those receptors right? And that sets up generator potentials, which are carried into the olfactory bulb, and there's some signal processing taking place, so we see a lot of connection between various kinds of association neurons, even within the olfactory bulb. All right, but we're not going to talk so much about that. What I think is interesting is that we have these olfactory receptor cells embedded in the epithelium, and then we even have stem bipolar cells. Here's a stem cell. Because these receptor bipolar cells live for a very short period of time, and when they die, we would lose the sense of smell. So they are regenerated. So here's an example of neuron regeneration, right, because of these stem cells within this olfactory epithelium. So that's kind of exciting, because what do you know about, say, spinal cord? Do neurons in the spinal cord ever regenerate? No, they don't, right, because they have oligodendrocytes. Well, here's a kind of neuron that loves to regenerate. So, I don't know, maybe we can transplant some of these cells into a spinal cord sometime to regenerate action potential pathways. But then what do you have to be concerned with? Maybe you'll start to smell with your back or something. No, I was just kidding. I was just kidding about that last one. But if one neuron can regenerate, probably we just need to figure out how it does it and teach other kinds of neurons in other parts of our body to do that. Yeah, question. No, they don't. But these up over here do. These up over here do. Bipolars do not. All right, so they conduct action potentials relatively slowly. Fortunately, they don't have to travel a long distance. They just have to go through the ethmoid bone. Right, if it's going to go from your brain down to your big toe, that would be a much different story. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. Because that's one of the important reasons. Because in the central nervous system, the myelin sheath is made from oligodendrocytes, not Schwann cells. Oligodendrocytes secrete inhibitory compounds that prevent the growth of a regeneration tube. All right, so it prevents those oligodendrocytes to produce another tube, and that tube is used to guide axon when it's rebuilding. And those inhibitory factors also inhibit the regeneration of the axon. So not only does it not know where to go, it doesn't know that it should rebuild the axon in the central nervous system. Peripheral nervous system, Schwann cells have an opposite effect. They readily form a regeneration tube. So they make like a little tunnel to the exact location where that damaged neuron should regrow and hook back up to. And Schwann cells also secrete a factor that enhances axon development and regrowth. So both of those reasons. So it's much easier to regain innervation in peripheral nervous system. And it's almost impossible in the central nervous system because of that, because of different kinds of myelin-producing cells. Yeah. Okay, so on these olfactory cilia, there are receptors for different odorant molecules, and unlike the gustatory system, your book might say there's maybe 1,000 different kinds of olfactory receptors, so you have a much broader range of smell sensations. But I just heard on the TV that now somebody is thinking there's maybe like 10,000 different kinds of receptors. So our sense of smell is much more developed and complex than it is for taste. Okay, but don't forget, if there is an odorant molecule over there on that side of the room, you can't smell it until what? It enters your nose and binds to a receptor on these olfactory neurons. That odorant molecule has to bind. All right, so you got what? You got receptor cells, supporting cells in the membrane, basal cells, and those basal cells are stem cells that can produce new receptor cells every couple months. But that doesn't mean that if you subject your nasal cavity to some very toxic chemicals, those stem cells can die as well. And if they die, then of course, then you'd lose your sense of smell permanently when that happens. And that does happen to people. Okay. And these kinds of receptors work through G proteins. And here, right, there's thousands and thousands of different kinds of olfactory receptors. But they all work through G protein coupled receptors. All right, any more questions on that? Okay, so here we go to ears and hearing. What kind of sense is this? Is it special or general sense? It's special, right? Because you can only hear with your ears, no other part of your body. Kneecaps just won't do it. So how is it that an ear can sense pressure variations, rapid changes in pressure in the air that surrounds us? All right, so if we look inside our ear, we're going to find this thing. All right, and when I say ear, can you break an ear down into its major components? What are the major components of an ear? I might have it here, I might not. Doesn't look like I have it. Oh yeah, I do. What are the three main components of an ear? You have an outer ear, right? A middle ear, and an inner ear. And what we were just looking at was the bony labyrinth that makes up the inner ear. Right? And that bony labyrinth has three parts to it. It has this thing that looks like a snail, that's a cochlea, right? And it has a vestibule, which is this big area right here, and it has then semicircular canals. So we have these three separate bony labyrinths. We have three separate senses that occur in the inner ear. All right, so how do these things work? Sound variations and sound pressure are focused into the external acoustic meatus by the auricle of the ear, and when that pressure runs into this membrane here that we call the tympanic membrane, it just doesn't sit there. Usually it doesn't just sit there. What does it do? It starts to vibrate back and forth. Vibrates back and forth, back and forth. And this tympanic membrane has an auditory ossicle connected to it, and that bone start, an ossicle just means a tiny little bone. This bone starts to vibrate, and that vibrates two more bones. Finally, the last bone that it vibrates is the stapes, and you can see the stapes kind of looks like a stirrup that somebody would use to ride a horse with. And it's connected to a soft spot on the vestibule. We call it a window. It's a membrane. And what's the shape or what's the footprint of the stapes here on that membrane? Does it look like a triangle? It looks like an oval, right? So that membrane we call the oval window because of that shape. So when the stapes vibrates back and forth, it takes that energy and puts it into that nice watery environment inside the vestibule. All right, so you might be wondering, why? What's the surface area of the tympanic membrane compared to this oval window? So what I'm asking, which one is bigger, tympanic membrane or oval window? Tympanic membrane is a lot bigger. So the reason why we have a middle ear is because it's very difficult for sound energy to enter a aqueous environment, right, or a watery environment. So just consider maybe you're at a pool someplace and I'm talking to you and you're in the water, I'm on the deck of the pool, and all of a sudden you figure out, well, you know, I don't want to listen to this guy anymore. What can you do? You just put your head underwater and my voice just doesn't carry underwater. That energy just doesn't match up right. So this device right here, all right, matches up the pressure in the air so that you have same pressure inside this watery environment. So small changes in the tympanic membrane produce large changes in that oval window membrane, right? So small vibrations, tympanic membrane, make for very large changes in the oval window so that energy can enter that watery environment. Okay, so you got outer, middle, and inner. And what do we want to talk about first? Okay, vestibular apparatus. I probably can't talk too much more other than, before we make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, the cochlea is responsible for the sense of hearing. And the vestibule is important for the sense of static equilibrium. And the semicircular canals are responsible for the sense of kinetic equilibrium. Sometimes we might want to call that dynamic equilibrium. And what did we say kinetic equilibrium is? Linear acceleration or angular acceleration? Angular acceleration, right? And I think you can see that if there is something in the semicircular canal, what can it do? It can go around and around and around in a circle, which maybe you could relate to as like a spinning motion. And in which ways can you detect spinning? There are three different ways. In how many different planes make up your body? There are three, right? There's transverse, sagittal, coronal. So you have a semicircular canal oriented in each of those planes, so it's easy to tell, right, if you're spinning right to left, hand over feet, right? And but if you're spinning at an angle, then, right, then you have some components from each three of these semicircular canals being added up so you can tell what direction that you're spinning in, right? So you can tell more than just in three directions. You can tell in any direction because you have special receptors, all right, in each of those three. They can be added together. So you have hearing, static equilibrium, and kinetic equilibrium. All right, so when we come back, I guess we're going to start with vestibular apparatus, and then maybe the last thing we're going to talk about in the ear is hearing with this cochlea. In Blackboard, there is, I think, a Word document that talks about all of the organs within the inner ear in terms of the bony labyrinth, the organ, the receptor cells, and what senses they're responsible for. And also, if you need an outer ear, a middle ear, and an inner ear for any of those. Right, so for hearing, you need an outer ear. So you should be able to answer that. What about equilibrium? Do you need an outer ear? So we'll think about that stuff next time.